After almost 2 years, an inspector's report on safety makes a hard landing at the offices of the FAA and Dallas-based Southwest Airlines. That's story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Concerns about lax FAA oversight and Southwest Airlines' own culture of safety. Other stories we're watching. How a Texas senator seems to be leading a new trend of politicians getting into podcasting in a big way. Also, Texas, a major player in the streaming wars. Who's winning and who isn't? And a death in the musical family of Willie Nelson. Biographer Joe Nick Potosky on the passing of Paul English. Those stories and a whole lot more today on the Texas Standard. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 13th day of February 2020. 13th day of February. There's a certain holiday coming up tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken, just as a reminder, of course. Some people say it was created by the card companies as a way to make money. You could try scribbling that on a card and see how it goes over, but I wouldn't recommend it. A public service announcement from your friendly host here at the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown, by the way. Great to have you with us. So here we are just a couple of days after the first presidential primary in the nation. You know who won on the Republican side. And on the Democratic side, well, declaring a winner is a bit more complicated because if numbers were all that mattered, Bernie Sanders was the clear winner. He got the most votes, but then again, Pete Buttigieg was the non-progressive Democrat who came in second and in a sense was the big winner for a more centrist wing of the Democratic constituency. Some media outlets talk like the big winner was Amy Klobuchar since she had such a strong showing, third place, close behind Buttigieg. You don't hear much, though, about the person with the most money in this race. But this week, he scored a big win, too. Not in the Granite State, mind you, but in the Lone Star State. Just how big a win is the salient question as we rocket towards Super Tuesday. Sherry Greenberg is a clinical professor at the University of Texas's LBJ School of Public Affairs, and she joins us now. Sherry, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
First off, let's start with some of this morning's news. What do you make of Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner's endorsement of former New York mayor and billionaire Michael Bloomberg?
Well, certainly it is a big endorsement for Bloomberg looking to Super Tuesday. And with all of the emphasis that he has put on Super Tuesday, millions of dollars of advertising here in Texas. And it fits in with a plan that we have seen him implementing around the country. And that is particularly seeking support from mayors and from African-American mayors in cities that he thinks are going to be imperative for him to gain the delegates that he needs in the states in Super Tuesday and beyond. And of course, also, Mayor Bloomberg has a foundation that has been very focused on cities since he left his term as mayor of the city of New York.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the investment that so many of these candidates, not just Bloomberg, but others have been making here in Texas. You have the former South Bend, Indiana mayor. We talked about Pete Buttigieg's campaign announcing they're ramping up efforts in Texas ahead of Super Tuesday. You got Bernie Sanders opening offices in Houston and San Antonio. He's got a rally in Dallas on Friday.
Yes.
So it does seem like everyone's coming to Texas, but correct me if I'm wrong here. I have a sense that not that long ago, there weren't a lot of candidates who'd come down to the Lone Star State to campaign in a presidential primary. Am I wrong about that?
Oh, no, you are so correct in that. In fact, for many years, Texas was looked at as a cash cow in that money people would come and not come to Texas, but contact Texans so that money could be sent out of Texas to fund their campaigns in other states. And so this is a big change that we have seen now for months going on here in Texas, where in fact, Texans' money is staying here, money from outside is coming in, and people are coming in, whether it was Warren with offices or Biden with, you know, presence. Mm-hmm. As you noted, Bernie Sanders today, Bloomberg has many offices, Buttigieg, of course, has had a big supporter in Mayor Steve Adler. Buttigieg is bringing in folks. So this is a sea change, really.
Yeah, but is that because of the number of delegates? I wouldn't think so. I mean, that's been pretty much stable, even though Texas has been growing, of course.
Well, but let's keep in mind that this is a very different situation than we've seen before. You don't just have two candidates vying in the Democratic primary. You have a cast of characters. Yes, the cast has condensed some, but you still have a cast of characters. Mm-hmm. And things are wide open, I think, going into Super Tuesday. You have had Iowa and New Hampshire, but those are two very similar states as far as demographics, right? Mm-hmm. With you know, a lot of just white people voting. That's not what you're going to see in Nevada. That's not what you're going to see in South Carolina. And with Super Tuesday, it really is this treasure trove of delegates. And within that treasure trove, Texas is a gold mine. You know, you're looking at over 200 delegates in Texas. So this is a big deal as far as looking forward to Milwaukee and the convention and gaining those delegates.
Sherry, just a couple of seconds left, but do you think that the endorsement actually moves the needle at all for Michael Bloomberg?
You're talking about the endorsement of Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner?
Exactly.
Yes, back to that. We shall see. Certainly, you know, we know that Houston is a major presence in Texas and in the nation. However, I don't think that we have seen Bloomberg really tested yet. He hasn't debated yet. We need to see. Certainly, he's been moving up in some polls, but we need to see what happens here in Texas, and we need to see if that can translate, that kind of endorsement from Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner, to actually, along with his strategy of all of this paid media, mm-hmm. to bringing in those votes that he needs.
Sherry Greenberg, clinical professor at the University of Texas's LBJ School of Public Affairs. Sherry, thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
With the Boeing 737 MAX scandal still fresh on people's minds, the phrase FAA oversight might sound to some like an unfortunate oxymoron. Critics claim that not only is the FAA too chummy with the industry it's supposed to regulate, but that safety is often relegated to the rear section. Now, after an almost two-year investigation of the FAA's oversight of Texas-based Southwest Airlines, the U.S. Department of Transportation's Inspector General is taking that a step further, not just criticizing lax oversight of the carrier, but raising questions about the culture of safety at Southwest. Joining us now is Dallas Morning News aviation reporter Kyle Arnold. He's been following the latest. Kyle, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Why was this investigation initiated in the first place? Is that clear?
This started after the Southwest Flight 1380 accident back in April of 2018. And that, if you remember, that was the one where a window was broken on the plane due to an exploding engine, and a woman was killed when she was partially sucked outside the plane. And this really launched that whole series of investigations into Southwest, their safety plan, and eventually what the FAA is doing to make sure that they're following that.
Over the years, Southwest has had a few run-ins with safety regulators, unless I'm mistaken. I'm pretty clear on that. This watchdog report says that Southwest, and I want to quote here, continues to fly aircraft with unresolved safety concerns. What sort of safety concerns are we talking about? Just how serious?
Well, the FAA is really strict, especially on how you maintain planes and kind of the documentation. Some of the big ones come from some foreign purchased aircraft, 88 of those, and they had big lapses in their safety and maintenance records. You know, it wasn't really that Southwest had time to fix that, but in one instance, they submitted the reviews to the FAA, and 71 of those were approved in a single day. It should take about 3 weeks to 4 weeks to do that. Those are the kind of big things that they said. You know, Southwest might have some problems with the way the FAA is overseeing Southwest is problematic as well.
You know, I think it's important to understand that Southwest has managed to keep its fares where they are because they take advantage of a lot of economies of scale within the industry. For example, they stick with the 737, and that means that they only have one parts bin, in a sense. You don't have to shop around for parts for a whole lot of different planes and train a whole bunch of different people. But there are some especially harsh words in this report, which says that the culture of safety was to use, quote, diversion, distraction, and power
to get what they want, I presume from the FAA. Those are pretty damning words. How widespread are these problems, and what is Southwest having to say about it?
Well, a majority of the FAA employees that were interviewed, those are the ones here at the Dallas office right outside of Southwest headquarters. You know, they said those kind of things. They said Southwest goes over their heads, then goes directly to FAA headquarters, which, you know, it's problematic, not only because is there problems here in Dallas, but there are problems up in Washington. They said Southwest just kind of does whatever they want, and that there's a lot of arrogance there. And the, you know, somebody said, you know, when they want to do something, they'll pretty much, they'll wait to do it, in quote, I'll respond to you when I damn well please. So I think that was the problematic relationship between these two, is the FAA didn't feel like, at least the employees didn't feel like they had a lot of authority over Southwest, even though they're the government regulator that's supposed to make sure they're keeping everyone safe.
But what does Southwest have to say about all this?
Southwest categorically denies everything. They said they have a great safety culture. They point back at their long history of not having any plane crashes that have resulted in fatality. That one that they had back in 2018 was the first one in their history where you can really point to something that happened to the airplane as resulting in a death. And if you look back at the NTSB investigation, that was really a fluke incident. And there's no way that they could have really predicted that engine fan blade would have broken off and caused all the damage it did.
Kyle Arnold continues to follow this story as aviation reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Kyle, thanks so much for speaking with us on The Standard.
All right. Have a great day.
All right, let's find out what Texans are talking about on social media. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. We're hearing from folks about Michael Bloomberg and how he's spending big to win in the Democratic presidential primary. With Bloomberg's campaign apparatus coming to Texas, here are some of the reactions we're seeing on social media. Via Facebook, Johnny Billet writes, Bloomberg was a staunch Republican until 2018. If there was ever any doubt that money is the driving force in politics, Bloomberg buying his way into the Democratic convention is proof of that. Similarly, Ozzie Zion Nelson asks, does he have any new ideas or is he just buying his way into this? That's the only question here. And Susan Rayburn writes, while Bloomberg is not my first choice, I will vote blue no matter who. Just, you know, one of the stories we're watching today, David.
Interesting story in the New York Times by Rebecca Ruiz, who says the Bloomberg campaign is a waterfall of cash in which the billionaire is deploying his corporation in service of his presidential bid. We'd love to hear from you, Texas. Tweet us at Texas Standard. Wells back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, celebrating spring break with golf beaches, seafood, and family-friendly attractions, including Moody Gardens, dolphin watching adventures, and more. Details at galveston.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories.
Hey, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We often hear that more people, especially millennials, are moving to the urban core, and there's a push for more housing in our cities. But considerable growth is also happening at the outer edges. The burbs are considered the most politically volatile spaces in all of Texas right now. When it comes to housing, as Houston Public Media's Florian Martin reports, make no mistake, the stereotypical single-family home isn't all that's in demand.
So this would be the master suite. The master suite.
Apartment manager Yolanda Burks gives us a tour of a new apartment complex in Cypress called Lakeside Row.
This aisle, you have the actual fire pit.
It's the latest addition to the master planned community Bridgeland. The majority of the development is single family homes. So far, there are four villages that are all a mix of homes, apartments, and businesses. Heath Melton is an executive vice president at the Howard Hughes Corporation, which is building the community.
Bridgeland is an 11,400-acre master plan community. We're 14 years in creation, and we currently have about 12,000 residents living within Bridgeland.
Of those, 450 live in the now two apartment complexes. Bruce McClenney is the president of Houston-based ApartmentData.com.
Katy Cinco Ranch Waterside has always been a submarket that has been attractive to apartment development as well as single-family development.
In just the segment in and around Katy, there are currently more than 2,500 apartment units under construction, according to apartmentdata.com. That rivals the Montrose Midtown Museum District submarket. The only area with more new apartment construction is the Heights Washington Avenue area. Overall, in Greater Houston, there are nearly 23,000 apartment units being built right now. Compare that to 30,000 single-family home starts in the past year, according to Metro Study. Lawrence Steen is the Houston Regional Director for the data firm.
Out of that, about 26,000 or so of those were in what you'd consider to be suburban locations.
So the vast majority of single-family homes are being built in the suburbs, which is what you might expect. But should we be surprised that half of all apartments under construction are also in the burbs? Wasn't the conventional wisdom that young renters want the urban life, close to jobs and entertainment? Again, Bruce McClenny.
Used to that, you know, people would go out and live in the suburbs and then drive into downtown or drive into the Galleria, and that's where most of the businesses were, where the jobs were. But that's the job scenario has changed.
Now McClenny says there are plenty of jobs in Katy or the Woodlands. And there's also an increasing selection of entertainment options. Heath Melton says for Bridgeland, a town center is planned. He says the types of people who choose to live in his suburban apartments vary greatly.
From young business professionals that obviously aren't married or have families just yet. We do have some families that are making that decision right now that are moving in.
And then there are people who want to first get a feel for the community before buying a house.
So they want to get in, kind of establish some roots, feel out the community before they make one of the biggest decisions in their life from a financial standpoint of purchasing a home, all the way up to the empty nester profile, those folks that are choosing a for rent product because they want that lower maintenance lock and leave lifestyle.
But even though it may feel that way, experts say the multifamily push to the suburbs isn't a new phenomenon. Again, developer Melton.
If you look at kind of life stages of communities in the suburbs, you'll see that generally how it takes place. The front end is always the single family, and then it's followed by retail, followed by other housing options, and then office components as well.
Those who track real estate data say that as long as people keep moving to Houston, development will push in all directions, but especially in the west of the city, where there's still plenty of empty land available. In Houston, I'm Florian Martin for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Who's winning the streaming wars? It's a headline you've probably seen if you follow entertainment news or tech news. Netflix, CBS, Apple, and a half dozen more are all fighting for a share of your entertainment dollar. Coming soon, Texas-parented HBO Max as well. Now, for the first time since the high-profile launches of several new services last fall, we have some numbers to tell us what and how much we're watching, an early answer to our initial question, perhaps. Who's winning the streaming wars? Tech expert Omar Gayaga joins us to break it all down. Hello there, Omar.
Hey, David. I took a break from my binge watching to come in here.
You just about have to, don't you? So Nielsen is in this game. Nielsen, these are the people that used to put set-top boxes back in the day when broadcast television was the only game in town, right?
Yeah, they started measuring streaming, video on demand stuff, I think in 2017. And at first, people like Netflix said, oh, you can't trust those numbers. We have our own proprietary data. Mm-hmm. And then I think they've kind of come around to, well, maybe they do have some good data. Maybe we should be paying attention to what our competitors are doing.
Well, see, that's the problem. If you have proprietary data, then everyone can claim that they've got whatever they want to. And that's not going to make for decent economics. I mean, that we're talking about a genuine war here.
Yeah. Netflix itself has kind of pointed out that you can't just look at adoption numbers. You can't just look at how many members, you know, these streaming services have, because, you know, Apple TV, you know, they're giving that away for a year. You know, you've got all these promos with Disney Plus. So, you know, a lot of that is promotions or giveaways. So you can't really just measure it just based on that. You've got to measure the actual watching of the shows.
So let's get to the meat and taters of this thing. What is it that Nielsen has to say about who's watching what and where?
Well, there's a couple of things that really stood out to me from the data they just released. One was that our consumption of streaming TV has doubled in the last 2 years. So that means that not only, you know, is this pie being fought over by all these companies, but the pie itself has gotten much bigger. So we're watching much more TV. And I think something like 60% of people subscribing subscribe to more than one of these. So there's overlap. You know, you might have Netflix and Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus. The other thing that stood out to me was just the sheer number of unique programs. Mm-hmm. I think they measured it as 646,152 unique program titles.
Good night.
And that's not like episodes. That's not, you know, like all the episodes of Friends combined count as one of those. So it's not like they're counting individual episodes.
This is the golden age of production is what it sounds like.
It's and catalog, you know, a lot of, you know, back catalog stuff. You know, when Disney Plus launched, part of the attraction was all these old movies and TV shows you forgot even existed.
Is there evidence that people are adding a number of channels to what they're already subscribing to? Because in that way, I mean, there might be fewer casualties at the end of the day when it comes to the streaming.
Yeah, some of it is cord cutting. Some of it is people being more open to the idea of adding more than one service at a time. It used to be, you know, Netflix and cable, Netflix and whatever else. Mm-hmm. But people seem to be more open to the idea of subscribing to two, three, four of these. And YouTube kind of emerged too. That was kind of a surprise for me, is that YouTube is second behind Netflix as the streaming service. You don't really think of YouTube as streaming TV, but a lot of people are watching it.
So Netflix in number one right now.
At about 31%. YouTube's at about 21%, and then followed by Hulu, Amazon, and then 28% of everybody else, which includes Disney Plus.
Well, I mentioned the Texas-based HBO Max, which is going to be coming online, I guess, in May of this year. Is there going to be anything left for them once they enter this party?
Yeah, that's the question. Are people, you know, it's people's budgets and finances. Are people willing to pay for how many of these? And some of these are cheaper. You know, CBS All Access and Disney Plus are cheaper than Netflix. So it's a matter of like looking at your finances and going, okay, I can afford four of these, but not five. You know, five would be way too much TV.
Oh boy. Never enough, it seems, though, at least right now, right? You can check out more of Omar Gayaga's tech news over at techminutetexas.com. And by the way, thanks for your tip about Disney Plus. Actually, even if you had never said anything about Disney Plus, I got so heavily lobbied on the home front. It was nuts.
They just added Toy Story 4, so you got that to
see, that's,
watch that.
That's right.
Omar,
good to see you again.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
We're coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. A whole lot more ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. Congress is a step closer to passing bipartisan legislation banning surprise medical bills for patients with federally regulated health plans who make up about 40% of the Texas insurance market. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports the bill was voted out of committee and is on its way to the full U.S. House.
Surprise medical billing happens when someone with health insurance goes to a hospital that is out of network or gets care from a provider who is out of their network, often without the patient knowing. And when insurers and medical providers can't agree on a price for that care, patients are many times left with the bill. Last year, Texas lawmakers banned this practice, and now both sides are required to use arbitration to figure out who is going to pay what. But that law only applied to people with state-regulated plans. Now the U.S. House is working to shield other patients. Congressman Lloyd Doggett, an Austin Democrat who has been working on this issue for many years, says the issue requires a balanced approach.
A balanced approach requires a process that doesn't leave physicians at the mercy of giant insurance companies, but also doesn't leave insurance companies facing runaway prices promoted by these private equity giants.
Doggett says private equity firms have been buying up medical providers, which has partly led to higher prices for health services. During the same House committee vote, lawmakers also approved of a bill that would increase transparency around medical providers who are purchased by private equity firms.
Ashley Lopez reporting. The University of Houston's new medical school can start accepting applicants after it received preliminary accreditation. The first class is expected to consist of 30 students and begin in late July. Dr. Steven Spann is the founding dean of UH's College of Medicine. He says Texas is facing a shortage of primary care doctors.
We believe that this will add additional physicians to a state that needs more physicians, and because our mission is to train more primary care physicians as well as other needed medical specialties, we're hoping that we will be able to contribute to narrowing that gap of primary care physicians as well.
Meanwhile, a proposal for a new University of Texas Medical School in Tyler is also getting a boost. The East Texas Medical Center Foundation says it's going to commit $80 million to the effort. The UT Board of Regents is scheduled to vote on the plan for the medical school on February 26th. Data the U.S. Drought Monitor released today shows about one-third of Texas remains in drought. At least 30% of the state has been suffering from drought since the fall. At the end of January, Governor Greg Abbott declared a state of disaster for 22 counties due to the dry conditions. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the law firm of Barron, Adler, Clough, and Odo, handling eminent domain and condemnation cases throughout Texas, protecting private property rights for over 30 years. BarronAdler.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. As cellular carriers bring 5G, their next generation of wireless technology, to the Lone Star State, some argue it will signal the fifth generation of digital inequality. In the past, carriers have typically rolled out their faster services to wealthier neighborhoods first. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav has been looking into the future of the digital divide.
This year, you're going to hear a lot about what 5G will do.
To say there's a lot of hype around 5G?
How it could help firefighters see through smoke
is probably an understatement.
Connect ambulances with hospitals in real time.
Verizon and T-Mobile spent an estimated $22 million in Super Bowl ads to tell us all about it.
Hey, Mama, I'm working.
It works at the pie shop.
T-Mobile's 5G works inside and out.
But what gets left out of the conversation is that 5G will likely not be rolled out citywide, but as in technologies past, predominantly to wealthier areas.
So I don't know how any of us can think that 5G will be different, that the ISPs will make different decisions than they did with previous technologies.
Angela Seifer works for the National Digital Inclusion Alliance, a nonprofit that advocates for connecting low-income and disconnected communities.
We know AT&T digitally redlined. We know they skipped low-income neighborhoods when they were rolling out their faster DSL. And we know this because of the data they gave to the FCC.
Unlike in banking, the redlining or lack of investment in poor communities isn't illegal. AT&T has said in the past that it doesn't redline, and that its investment in inclusion and diversity is unparalleled. Responding to one FCC complaint over redlining in 2017, it said its rollouts are based on costs and forecasts of utilization. As a result, 5G won't close the so-called digital divide, Seifer says. In fact, it will speed the obsolescence of technology low-income people can afford. It will likely make the divide worse. But there was a window where cities thought they could make a difference. See, 5G requires a lot more connection points, a denser network of what are called small cell nodes, and telecoms wanted to put thousands of them in city rights-of-way and on city-owned poles. That would have given cities a lot of leverage, says Austin Stevenson with the city of McAllen.
And McAllen was offering a substantial discount on their rental rates if the providers would place any type of Wi-Fi hotspot. It doesn't even have to be 5G, just some kind of internet connectivity to those lower income areas or areas that are without service.
But then the state legislature changed the rules in 2017, capping fees to between 10 and 25% of their market value and made it nearly impossible for cities to not approve a permit request. San Antonio Mayor Ron Nurberg says the power to disincentivize is gone.
The way the regulatory structure exists today at the federal, state, and local level, we are largely reliant, almost entirely reliant on carrots and not sticks.
Good morning, sir. Do you have a couple minutes? We'd really appreciate your time. Happy Friday.
One in four San Antonio homes don't have internet, but we don't know where those homes actually are.
Good morning, ma'am. After you're done, we have a survey, if you don't mind. It's about internet usage.
San Antonio City employee Thomas Guerra is working to document the city's digital divide at a West Side payment center for the local utility. The surrounding zip code has a median income of $28,000, and nearly a third live in poverty. Many people pass by uninterested, but he draws one or two.
Is it in Espanol, or would you like it in English?
English.
Okay, perfect. Are you a resident of Bexar County?
Yes.
This survey will be turned into a map of city districts showing just how good or bad the problem is. City staff hope they can convince providers to build access into some of these areas, says San Antonio Chief Innovation Officer Brian Dillard.
I'm going to give you the tool sets and resources that you need to make the right decision. I'm going to put it on you to make that decision moving forward. That's all the leeway I have.
And even then, it's just access. It doesn't address whether people can afford the $60 to $75 monthly cost. and the cost of a new device. But Angela Seifer argues because of the rental rate cap for the rights of ways, the community is essentially subsidizing these companies. Can't they make the rates more affordable?
Our most disadvantaged community members end up not participating in that public investment. That is happening now.
The chances that 5G would bridge the digital divide was slim already. With rule and law changes at the state and federal level in recent years, Seifer said it's nearly impossible. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
Well, it may have been a decade ago, but researchers now say the BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico may have spread much further than initially thought, reaching as far as the Florida Keys. The New Orleans Advocate reports that scientists have gathered data from water and seafloors to visualize an oil plume that may have been invisible to satellite imagery at the time. Lingering effects have included ongoing health concerns for some coastal residents, early responders, and some marine life. We're fast approaching 39 minutes past the hour at Texas Standard Time. There's a whole lot more just ahead, including a goodbye to a member of Willie's musical family. Stick around.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, celebrating spring break with golf beaches, seafood, and family-friendly attractions, including Moody Gardens, dolphin-watching adventures, and more. Details at galveston.com.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm Marika Flatt, travel editor with Texas Lifestyle Magazine, here with your weekend trip tip. Isolated on a 13-mile stretch of land in central Texas stands a forest of pines known as loblollies. Because this unique forest is located more than 100 miles away from its closest genetic match, the loblolly pines are often referred to as the Lost Pines. One way to lose yourself in the Lost Pines is to stand on a wooden platform more than 100 feet over the forest and jump off, with a harness and helmet, of course. Zip Lost Pines has an intricate system of pulleys and weights, and you'll grow more enthusiastic and confident after each zip. With an 18-hole championship golf course, full spa, tennis courts, swimming pools, and a lazy river, the Hyatt Regency Lost Pines Resort and Spa does a great job of embodying the Texas spirit without being kitschy. Country music keens on the speakers, and a portion of its more than 400 acres is dedicated to a small sampling of Texas livestock. The immensely popular Lost Pines Corral provides the guest an opportunity to get up close and personal with its two longhorn steers who live on the property, along with alpacas, mini horses, goats, and a pig named Beans who loves belly rubs. The resort has a number of places to eat, and due to its temperate climate, it's almost always possible to eat al fresco. Before heading home, be sure to make a stop at the Berdahl Pecan Candy and Gift Company, located nearby on Interstate 71. The family-owned operation produces and sells five varieties of pecans that are the highest quality you'll find anywhere. And on the off chance that they're closed, you can buy pecans and homemade pies from the customized vending machine that sits on their front porch. That's your weekend trip tip. I'm Marika Flatt for the Texas Standard.
Marika is travel editor for Texas Lifestyle Magazine. You can check out more of her weekend trip tips at texasstandard.org. Yesterday, the world lost one of the original outlaws of country music, a true outlaw too. Paul English was not only Willie Nelson's drummer, but a friend and protector for over a half a century. Quite the character. You might have seen him decked out in a black satin cape with red lining, the money man for the band, ready with a 22 if the need were to ever arise. But his reputation was such that it seldom did. Truth is, English himself has said that joining Willie Nelson's band in the mid-1960s saved him from prison or worse. We know all this because Texas-based music writer and Willie Nelson biographer Joe Nick Petoskey wrote what's considered to be the definitive article about Paul English for the Oxford American a few years back. Joe Nick, great to have you join us again on the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David. It's good to be here, but not under these circumstances.
Indeed. For the uninitiated, Paul English was more than just a colorful drummer in Willie's band. Their association went way back to the mid-1950s, didn't it?
It was in 1955, Willie met Paul when Paul tagged along with his older brother, Oliver, who was a guitarist, and he was appearing on Willie's radio show in Fort Worth, and Paul tagged along. He wasn't really a drummer, but he learned how to drum on the spot, and he actually played a few gigs later on with Willie back in 55, and then they both went on their separate ways, but they never stayed out of touch, and Paul really looked up to what Willie was doing. So he joined the band in 1966 and has been with the band ever since.
Why was he such an important part of this organization? I mean, he was even immortalized in a Willie Nelson song, right?
It's Willie's first real turn at being an outlaw, his autobiographical song, Me and Paul. And it talks about their adventures touring on package shows in the late 1960s.
It's been rough and rocky traveling, but I'm finally standing upright on the ground. After taking several readings, I'm surprised to find my mind still fairly sound.
This was the time when Willie was trying to make it as a performer. He had already made it as a songwriter. Unfortunately, back in those days, trying to play in country music joints, honky-tonks, was a rough trade, and you know, you were likely as not to get paid. It was a difficult situation. And Willie needed some muscle. He needed someone behind him who would make sure that he got paid. And when Willie was looking for another drummer, Paul asked Willie, why not me? And Willie was surprised because Paul took a financial haircut. He was making a lot of money being basically a police character, a pimp, a hustler, a guy that ran numbers, a guy that ran all kinds of rackets. So for him to quit his job to go to work for Willie was a sacrifice. But he saw what everyone else saw and what Willie knew. Willie needed some protection if he was going to participate in this touring business.
I guess Nashville was the roughest, but I know I've said the same about them all. We received our education in the cities of the nation, me and Paul.
So a real outlaw country musician, for sure. But what about his drumming? I mean, what kind of musician was he?
You know, he talked about when he first sat in with Willie on the radio station, he just kind of tried to keep a rhythm. He was playing with a soda crate and all just basically, you know, kind of improvising his way. And he didn't know what he was doing, but he loved the idea of what music was and what it did and how it affected people. And I think that always, you know, spoke to him. So really his strength was as a drummer was keeping this really steady mid-tempo rhythm, which on a song like Me and Paul, it's almost a shuffle, a country shuffle, but that's Paul at his best. And of course, since the 1990s, he's been working mainly on brushes, kind of toning down Willie's sound a lot as the band matured.
I think it's hard to overlook the fact that a big part of this story isn't just Paul English, and as colorful as he was, there's a kind of loyalty. I mean, Willie Nelson talks about the family band, but the loss of Paul English is truly like the loss of a family member.
It's the loss of probably the most important family member. This is Willie's best friend. I mean, it's not just his drummer. This is Willie's business partner. Paul and him were doing business. I mean, Paul ended up taking over the books not too long after he joined the band, and he's been the accountant. And if you ever get behind the scenes at a Willie Nelson concert, long before Willie arrives, Paul is there orchestrating everything. So you can't measure this loss. There is a hole. This hole's not going to be filled. Everybody knows it. You can't invent another character like Paul. He was one of a kind, and he was really a remarkable human being. For a writer to be able to write his story was, you know, it's been a gift because, you know, stories like this don't come across every writer's purview. And I was just real lucky to get to witness this and to get to know Paul.
Joe-Nick Potoski is the author of Willie Nelson, An Epic Life, and he's been talking with us today about Willie's longtime drummer, Paul English, born in Vernon, up in North Texas, who passed away yesterday at the age of 87. Joe-Nick, thanks for joining us.
Hey, David, thank you, and God bless Paul English.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The saying everybody has a podcast these days might be hyperbole, but not by much.
I get very little from people screaming at each
3 minute sound bites yelling over each other
and just the talking points blah 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 wah wah wah. It's like a Charlie Brown and the teacher what they're talking.
Yeah, that's Senator Ted Cruz chopping it up with co-host Michael Knowles. Together they host Verdict with Ted Cruz, a podcast the senator started during the Senate impeachment trial. The idea was to take listeners behind the scenes of an historic moment in history, but now since it shot to the top of the podcast charts, Senator Cruz has stuck with it, and he's evidently inspired some of his colleagues at the Capitol, too, among them Houston Republican Dan Crenshaw, who's launched a show called We Hold These Truths just a few days ago. It's a trend that Stephanie Martin has been watching with great interest. She is an assistant professor of political communication at Southern Methodist University, SMU. She's also an avid podcast listener, and she joins us now on the Texas Standard. Dr. Martin, welcome to the Texas Standard.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I mentioned that everyone has a podcast these days. Why does it matter if a politician does it too? I mean, everyone has a Twitter handle, right? Is it that big of a deal?
Well, we can never forget that we live in the age of Trump. This is always the simplest answer, especially when it comes to politics. You know, Trump made so evident the value of controlling the media, putting out your own message, and even coming up with your own version of the facts and your own version of the news. And podcasting is a way to reach out and directly find people and directly compose your own version of events. And I think that's a lot of what's going on.
You know, I think you're making a very interesting point here, because it used to be that the media sort of mediated a politician's message. Now, of course, you're not just transcending what the media would normally do in its role covering politics, but in a way you are kind of mediating the media, because you have staged events like rallies or you release an incendiary tweet, and now we have podcasts being used for something very similar, sort of driving the news cycle in a sense.
Yes, I think what is really good about podcasting from a politician's point of view is that it invites a lot of control. You are in charge of what you say. You don't even have to go about finding a friendly interviewer. So for all the complaining about MSNBC on the left or Fox News on the right, in this case, the leader, Ted Cruz or Crenshaw, they write the questions and the answer, right? So it's almost a chance to reinforce the kind of brand that they want to be seen as. It's freedom that you don't accidentally get asked something you didn't want to talk about.
Mm-hmm. But having said that, since we all know that these podcasts do that, they perform that function, unless you're just wanting to have your own political beliefs validated or reaffirmed, why would they be interesting? Why would they be worth listening to if you are part of the great body electorate, if you will?
Yeah, it is less clear what constituents and voters get out of listening to these podcasts. One of the things that research shows is that it has a feeling of being somehow intimate, right? More intimate than what we maybe are doing here, because this just gets, all you have to do is turn on your radio and it's just happening on the Texas Standard. But for those who listen to this on podcasting, it's like you actually invite it onto your phone or onto your podcasting device. And so downloading requires an active invitation that suggests the kind of loyalty and engagement, and you're getting to know someone and you're invited into their private conversation. And I think that that's what constituents feel like they're getting. It's all a ruse. That's not really what's going on. But that's the appeal of it.
Well, you know, scholars, including yourself, I would imagine, have been, you know, tolling the bell for mainstream media for some time. We've seen newspapers folding. I think the McClatchy chain declared bankruptcy today. Mm-hmm. If you are part of traditional media, What does this mean for you?
Well, you see traditional media doing podcasts themselves, right? One of the stories about the Ted Cruz podcast with The Verdict, and we'll see if he can continue to maintain the audience that he had during the impeachment trial, because he's not an expert podcaster, and podcasting is actually very difficult. You have to get the media just right, and media folks like yourself are better at doing sound quality and audio quality and thinking up things to talk about, ready, right? Every day you have to come up with a show and do something that's interesting. And you see things like the New York Times every day puts out the daily, and NPR every morning will send you a podcast so that you can get the day's headlines. And so media themselves and big media are responding to the podcasting trend by sending out podcasts themselves. It will be interesting to see how this works going forward.
Stephanie Martin is an assistant professor of communication studies at Southern Methodist University. Dr. Martin, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Social media editor Wells Dunbar has been monitoring what Texans are talking about on this Thursday. What you seeing out there?
Hey, David. We were just hearing about the boom in politicians and podcasts led by a couple of Texas politicos, Ted Cruz and Dan Crenshaw. Folks on our Facebook page seem divided on the merits of this newfound trend. There, Philip White argues that the politicians are basically setting up a propaganda machine for once they're ousted. However, Joshua Bolton says, I imagine the boom is due to the press's inability to quote or put things in their full context.
You know, when you, at the end of the day, you don't have to listen to these podcasts, right? The curious thing is that you see, you know, chopping it up with you know, the first, second, third place contenders, you know, the Joe Rogans out there. You're seeing Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
That's pretty phenomenal.
And it truly is. And not to downplay that, but I think you touched on this right now. Will it continue to have that sort of staying power once the novelty has worn off? I think oftentimes when you see it, like, you know, the rankings, it's kind of like the newest podcasts, the latest download, or the latest download numbers you see. So will be interesting to see if this does have some legs and where folks will take it from there. Well, as you noted earlier, some news about the news that's making headlines. McClatchy, America's second largest local news company, filing for bankruptcy today, Thursday. The publisher said it's a move to restructure its debt obligations, largely pensions. And of course, here in Texas, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram is one of McClatchy's daily 29 daily newspapers across the United States. The company says the restructuring means McClatchy will change from family ownership to being purchased by a private equity fund, should all go according to plan there. Lots of people chiming in about this one. Robert Flood, via our Facebook page, laments that we are losing our newspapers to the ever-increasing world of new delivery technologies, and asks, how can the printed page for news ever be competitive with our new internet-connected devices that deliver news on 24/7 updates? Closer to home, closer to home perspective, Chris Hammock via Twitter. He writes that this is the time of year I'm extra aware of the Star-Telegram's importance because they are such a good source for down-ballot candidates and local propositions.
Many years ago, there was a fascinating book called Mediamorphosis, and it noted that over the years, as new technologies have come online, including television and for that matter, radio, there has been a declaration, it's the end of radio, it's the end of television, it's the end of movies, it's the end of... So I don't know. I'd be a little bit wary to declare the end of whatever, you know, newspapers. However, you know, you look at all of the layoffs in the newspaper business over the past 20 years, and it's that's just a... hard thing to deny.
And McClatchy says they're not going anywhere, but they are attempting to pivot less, more to a digital footprint rather than this print media one.
Nobody seems to have a clear answer on how to get out of this. Listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but we'd love to hear from you. Let us know what's making news in your neck of Texas by looking for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. We're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.